name's June, I'm an addict. I don't like it either. It's horrible. I feel like I'm melting. It's really hot, really sticky. Just drove 160 miles and I'm going to drive another 160 miles when I finish speaking. I don't say that for any other reason other than that's my reality. I've got to drive a lot of bloody miles. And I feel really hot and I feel really sticky and I thought it was just me because I feel slightly overweight. You know, I feel a bit self-obsessed. Not because of what you lot might think, but because of what I think. I've learned today that, you know, through the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, it doesn't really matter what you lot think. What matters is what I think. You know, I approach the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous seeking freedom, not fear. If I sit here and I worry about what other people think of me, then I'm never going to have any time to think about myself or take inventory or develop myself internally. You know, I heard some talk about the internal condition that I as an addict suffer from, and that's based within fear. You know, I don't come from a very comfortable place. I've been in and out of children's homes from the age of 3. Sexually abused him at the age of 11, stabbed in my face at the age of 13, and I started my first prison sentence at the age of 14. At the age of 6, I sniffed gas in a toilet in a children's home, and it changed the way I felt. You know, I had a very distorted, was it a grasp? No, I had a distorted reality, very, very distorted, and it was distorted by misguided belief systems and a lot of family dysfunction. And that family dysfunction still goes on. I'm just not part of it anymore. You know, I go into it, I sit there, I'm quite comfortable watching them, and I think you're all nuts, and I leave. And I drive 160 miles and I go home to my dog on the beach, really peaceful. Unless I invite chaos into my life. You know, and I'm just as susceptible to inviting a little bit of chaos into my life as a person that's just walked through the door. I'm not exempt from pain. You know, I do believe that it's a choice. I do believe that my eyes are open enough and I've got enough experience to see it when it's coming, but sometimes when it's coming it still looks attractive. And I'm not here to kind of put myself on a pedestal. I don't like them. I don't want to be on a pedestal. I don't want to be a voice of Narcotics Anonymous. I don't want to be any of that stuff. I'm just another addict trying to get another day clean. And a lot of them days in the week I struggle. I struggle with the storm of life. I struggle with what reality can bring to the table sometimes. You know, I find it hard to be okay with what I've got, always looking for something outside of myself that I haven't got. That, you know, the momentums of instant gratification. Oh, I like your jeans. Stupidness. Well, there can be some big ones as well. I won't say it. But ultimately, this is a 12-step program, right? So I can sit here all day long and I can talk about myself for the next 40 minutes and probably tell about 40 lies. So what I'd prefer to do is just carry the message within the 12 steps. You know, my experience of working the 12 steps. Because I believe that's where the hope lies. I believe that's the message of Narcotics Anonymous. And I believe that's the freedom for the newcomer who's, you know, in their first meeting or the old timer that's been here for 20 years. And I found it in the literature. It doesn't matter whether you're approaching these steps for the first time or the 20th time, the steps are our solution. I've come to understand that as being really important. I need to read the literature. I need to be transparent and honest with at least one other person under God. And I need to seek an understanding, a personal understanding of a power greater than myself. That's my purpose for being here. Because outside of that gear, without engaging in that gear, without engaging in that process, what happens to me is I have spiritual and emotional rock bottoms clean. You ain't had one till you've had one clean. That doesn't take anything away from what anybody's experiencing in the horrors of, or the grips of this disease. But I'm an addict, and when I go through stuff, I want to use. And to stay clean through them moments, it's really courageous. It's really courageous. So if you're going through something, it'll pass. Just hang on. So, you know, kind of, in step one, I quickly kind of understood that I was powerless because I stunk. Didn't eat. I weighed very little. You know, I had too many arrest warrants on me to remember. And they'd like, you're wanted. Yeah, what for? I don't know. Because there were so many of them. I've used in pretty much every dark corner in London. Predominantly, I grew up in an area of North London that's got quite a bad drug problem. And one of the things that happened to me was for, you know, abusing drugs or seeking seeking peace within my drug addiction for the best part of 29 years, what happened was I realised when I woke up 29 years later that the one thing that I had no experience in was relationships of any nature, you know, especially with myself. I had no kind of healthy investment in the relationship that I had with society, otherwise I wouldn't have been such a thieving little person. You know, I really struggled with relationships. And what happened for me was in the relationship that I had with my drug abuse, with, you know, finding ways and means to get and use drugs by any means necessary. You know, I did not sell candy floss when I was using. I went out there and I did whatever I had to do. You know, and I'm not here to judge anybody who's had to do whatever they've had to do, because I understand what this disease can do to us. And anything it hasn't done to me is just a yet, if I choose to pick up. You know, I'm waking up after about 29 years, realising how powerless I was, realising how unmanageable my life was, realising how scared I was, and realising how many people I'd pushed away and how many bridges I'd burnt. I felt really alone, really scared, really fearful, really vulnerable. You know, yeah, I'm a man. I felt vulnerable. I didn't like it. And the first thing that I did was I kind of used a defence system known as aggression. Don't look at me. Don't come near me. Don't hug me. Don't talk to me. You know, and I'd done that in this fellowship. I met this fellowship in 1994. I didn't actually get a day clean until 2006. So that was 15 years of research and a hell of a lot of not listening. And it was unnecessary. It was unnecessary. You know, but you kind of, I'm the proof of what he says in the literature. Until the addict's ready, they're not ready. If they, you know, if I come in here and I'm open and I'm prepared to be honest and I'm willing to listen to what it is you guys are saying, that, you know, no addict need die from the horrors of this disease and any of us can find freedom. If I'm not prepared to listen to that, but I don't believe that it's going to work for me, which is something that I didn't believe, then chances were I was going to do some more research, and I did lots of it, to the point of my brother dying in my arms in 2001. From a cardiovascular collapse. He smoked a pipe and it bust his heart and it bust his lungs. It took him 45 minutes to die in a psychosis, and it was horrible. You know, like smoking in the third floor flat, and the wind blew the letterbox, and my imagination told me it was something else, and I jumped out the window, broke my back, shattered my pelvis, shattered my left leg, and shattered my left shoulder. Bounced, scored, used in a bush for 6 hours. So, you know, yeah, I definitely belong to step one. And that obsession and that compulsion to actually, you know, it didn't really matter what was happening around me. You know, the mention of suicide, you know, I didn't care if I died, in truth. I didn't think about it. I just didn't care. You know, I was in that place where, you know, I was just kind of really on, really destitute spiritually, just really empty. You know, and like I said, I kind of made some abandoning. And, you know, when I was growing up, both my parents were addicts. You know, one was an alcoholic, one was a prescription abuser. Both of them were unavailable. They always used to fight. Insanity was quite common ground. The dysfunction was quite normal. Criminality was normal. All the stuff that isn't really quite normal was normal. I'd been desensitised, it had been normalised, and I'd grown up in it, and I was wondering why society was giving me such a hard time for just being what I'd been nurtured in. That's not me placing blame. I love my parents. They did the best they could. It's not for me to walk around the place with my heart laden with resentments and placing blame upon the shoulders of other people. I need to stand up in this fellowship and take responsibility for me. Yeah. I need to do that. Because otherwise, if I don't do that, I find myself in a hell of a lot of blame that's just unnecessary. You know, so I kind of had to quickly agree that in step two, I was insane. And I felt really comfortable because every time I walked in here, or even now when I just walked in, I felt like I was walking into a hotbed of mental health. I'm not alone. I'm not alone. I'm not the only one. You know, I'm not the only one that has disturbing thoughts. Driving into London, driving through London, some mad flipping van driver behind me and my sponsor and a friend. And I don't know what he was doing, but I immediately went into anger. I didn't volley out the window, but I wound the window down, you know, because I felt threatened. And my head does some funny things to me, you know, so that insanity can still come up, you know. And, you know, step two and the insanity and being restored and the therapeutic value of one addict talking to another is that, you know, I was sitting here for 15 minutes just now and I heard someone that was lost in the right direction and not necessarily in pain, but on the break of finding the restitution that this programme promises. But there's some work to do. You know, and if you're anything like me, don't be. I took 18 months to get a sponsor and work the steps. I understand what clean and crazy means. It's bloody unnecessary and it's painful. And they were patient with me. One of them sitting over there, the other one's in Birmingham, who's still my sponsor now, and he lost his dad 2 days ago, and I love him dearly, and I feel his pain. You know, so kind of stepped into step three. And in step three, what I kind of had to do was look around the fellowship to people. Because, you know, when I first came here, some of you were talking a good one, but I didn't believe you was clean. You was all up to kind of all different types of stuff that you'd never admitted or said anything to me about, but I had a really good imagination. You know, and but the main thing that I kind of really, really needed to be here for was to hear that message of hope where addicts were telling me that they'd come from the same place as me, you know, out of cardboard boxes and out of dustbin shoes, and actually now they were standing in a position in life of responsibility and, you know, integrity, and they had jobs and they could afford their bills and they didn't have to look over their shoulders anymore, and, you know, I see them coming to meetings with their children with smiles on their faces. And I wanted it. You know, I kind of got 2 children. One's 30, the other one's 24. Also, I was busy smoking crack cocaine in my insanity in bin chutes and telephone boxes and anywhere else I could shelter my pipe but not my body. You know, my son was getting an education for himself. And, you know, also I was busy doing that, he became the political liaison's officer for the Houses of Parliament whilst his dad was smoking crack. And the security checks that they put him under because of me was horrendous, but he passed them on his own, based on his own integrity. You know, so when I came in here, what I really needed was to be delivered from that place of pain, shame, guilt, remorse that I think all of us feel, especially around being a parent and being, you know, around my children. You know, I feel really ashamed of inflicting them with the same abandonment and rejection that I inflicted on my children by justifying and saying, well, yeah, that was how I was brought up. So what? It's not an excuse. It's not good enough. You know, I experience what I experience from my parentage doesn't make it okay for me to give it to my kids. I needed to find restitution. Because once upon a time, that's exactly what it was, okay. You know, if you'd been through what I'd been through and all that other stuff, you know. So I'd kind of found a lot of people in this fellowship that were kind of delivering a message of hope, and it was based upon some of the same experiences or stuff that I was feeling that I couldn't quite put into words, or, you know, just identification. And that kind of compelled me, because when people were talking in that way and they were telling me, yeah, me too, me too, me too, keep coming back, Junior, it'll be all right, it'll pass. You know, talking about spiritual attacks and talking about the feelings and emotions, the things we have the most of and know the least about, especially when we get involved with someone of a different sex. You know, scary, mate. Don't know about anybody else, but when I first come around and I'd done that, it was nice, but it was bloody scary. You know, and I made a hell of a lot of mistakes, and I come to understand also that, you know what, my humble experience is if you're not making mistakes, then are you recovering? Because I don't learn by getting it right, I learn by getting it wrong. You know, but I was kind of sick and tired of getting it wrong, so I needed to do some more work, and I needed to step into step four, and I needed to step into step four honestly. The spiritual principle of step four is honesty. My first step four was anything but honest. I was involved in all kinds of stuff that I wasn't involved in. You know, and eventually I'd done another step four, and I'm coming up for double figures, you know, in June. And I'm about to read out my 5th step 4 and 5. Because the job's never done for me. There's different levels of damage in this fellowship and different rates of recovery. I don't go through the work once and all of a sudden I'm free from everything. No, that's not my experience. My experience is I've had to keep on chipping away. How free do you want to be? Well, it depends on how much work you're prepared to do. You know, and I doubt this will be my last 4 or 5. Or I doubt if it will be my last whole 1 to 12. You know, So I kind of went into step four and I started to discover some stuff, namely these things that we kind of label up in this fellowship of defects of character. The stuff that I'm capable, the exact nature of my wrongs and what I bring into relationships that causes a dysfunction that I'm the most consistent part of. Me. It cannot happen without me. You know, and my reality was in, you know, in the resentments, in the relationships, in all areas of my step four. Sponsors kept on saying to me, what was your part? Because in that area, I realised that I was riddled with blame. I blamed everybody. Everybody, the authorities for my prison sentences, and the only thing that I wasn't responsible for was the fact that I was taken into care at the age of three, and that was, even that wasn't a good enough reason to kind of carry any kind of resentments. And resentments just block me up, man, and the person that I become is not someone that I like. I don't care what anybody else thinks. I don't like the person I become. I didn't want to be handcuffed to that. I didn't want to be attached to it. I was seeking a freedom that I didn't really kind of, I wasn't sure if it existed. You know, and when I was going through step four and I was approaching it honestly and I was bearing my soul and talking to them, because I was 38 when I first mentioned the fact that I'd been sexually abused. I mean, this is being recorded. Members of my family don't even know that, because it's not for them to know. It was for me to kind of air. You know, and in step four, I really had a kind of deep, meaningful look at the fact that, you know, I had a lot of things that had happened to me that I used to kind of go around in life in a distorted way. And yeah, I was inflicting pain on society and other people that were unfortunate enough to be around me, but the person that I smashed to pieces was myself, without any concern for whether or not I lived or died. I didn't care, and I don't believe that any spiritual or human being or anything with a spirit in it should be walking around feeling like that. Unfortunately, the world's riddled with us, you know. So I started to discover some stuff about myself in step four, and I started to make some real honest admissions to another human being and you know, another human being and God. And at that time, you know, in early recovery, I didn't have a concept of God. I was really kind of quite adamantly against it. You know, I didn't like people that spoke about God. I didn't like people that mentioned his name. And, you know, it kind of, I don't know, well, I didn't know then why, but I know now. You know, I kind of had a block from God for the first 7 years of my recovery. And that was basically because I kind of blamed God for everything that man does in his name. You know, and actually it's got nothing to do with God, what we do in his name. That's just us blaming God for something that we do. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in this world, but this is a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, that stuff kind of scares me. But it also gives me the ability, you know, when I kind of sit down and I think about some of the routes that I took towards, you know, finding ways and means to use drugs, or sometimes just being selfish in my criminality and seeking money. You know, some of the justifications that I'd use would be attached to politicians and stuff like that. And I'd say, well, if they can do it, so can I. So I was really kind of misguided and, you know, kind of had to make these admissions to another human being. And so far I've had three sponsors, you know, and you know, my first sponsor's in the room. Second sponsor I went through to work with, he moved away and went to another person because I needed to find a power. I sought sponsorship specifically for that at 7 years clean because I had emotional and spiritual rock bottom. You know, and that kind of shows me that, you know, in my step four and my step five, there was some stuff that I hadn't yet dealt with. There were some manifestations that had not yet been exposed to me. I hadn't experienced them yet. You know, I see other people saying they was going through stuff and I'd have an opinion on what I was hearing. Well, it's not the same as having an experience of what they was talking about, you know. And eventually I started having more and more of these painful storm-like situations that life can bring, you know. And it brought me to my knees at 7 years clean, and it brought me to my knees. I was kind of really in a lot of emotional and spiritual pain. And here's the really scary part. I didn't think about using. I didn't think about suicide in my using, but at 7 years clean, I thought about suicide. Thank you. You know, and that's scary, that, you know, at 7 years clean and a lot of pain for the manifestations that this disease can develop within me or around me, the spiritual attacks, the motivation towards acts of instant gratification because my days are just not going very well, you know. This stuff didn't come out in my first step four or my second step four. In fact, they only started to kind of come up in my third and my fourth step four. And now, in my fifth step four, I've got real clarity around it. I know what goes on around me and I know what I suffer from and I know how it comes up and I know what affects me and I know when I'm stepping into it and I know when it's my fault, you know, so... My understanding of step four has developed the more times I've done it, you know, and coming out of four and five, stepping into the engine room of six and seven, you know, I need to find these defects of character that I'm repetitively repeating and minimising on and saying, oh, it's okay, that there's a lot of stuff that I've actually become quite painfully comfortable with in my recovery that needs to go. And I don't believe that job will ever be done. I need to keep on doing it and keep on going and keep on going, you know, because the reality of it is, for 29 years, I used drugs and that's all I did. I don't really know how to live. I don't really know how to live. And it doesn't really matter whether I'm coming up for 10 years or not. The fact of the matter is this disease has still got me beaten in the amount of time that I use drugs. I've got a lot to learn. I've got a lot to learn and I'm prepared to learn it. You know, I have to remain teachable in this fellowship. You know, and stepping into six and seven and owning my part and the defects of character that... Once upon a time, my defects of character used to harm the people that I'd used them on. And then what happened was, in recovery, I gained this thing that we can't give back called a conscience, and it started to affect me. I'd see the looks of disappointment or the looks of pain upon the people's faces that I was harming and not taking any responsibility for it. The fact that I was in 6 and 7 and I'd claimed to do a step 10, 11 and 12, but yet I weren't practising them. I weren't practising step 11 and 12. At 7 years. That's what went wrong. I'd done the 12, but I weren't practicing maintenance. And I learned a valuable lesson I didn't use. By the skin of my teeth, I didn't use. You know, so I kind of went back and I had another look at 6 and 7. And at 7 years clean, I found 46 active defects. 46. You know, and I was taken through a method of, you know, understanding and identifying them defects of character. And then them defects of character, I was sent into prayer for 21 days, asking for the 46 defects of character to be removed on a daily basis for 21 days. And at the end of 21 days, what happened was, I knew the defects of character by name. 21 days later, calling them out every morning, I kind of got familiar with them, and they got familiar with me. And then for another 21 days in step 7, I was asked to seek out and pray for the 46 spiritual principles, which were the antidotes to the defects, and 42 days later I knew the way in and I knew the way out, and that was the engine room. That's what happened to me. But it took me a while to get to that point in my recovery, and I didn't experience that the first time round my steps. I'm not trying to scare anybody. What I'm saying is that, you know, for me this gear's been a process, and some stuff's been delivered to me from the messages of our fellowship and the messengers in our fellowship, and I just haven't been in the right place to wear it at the right time. You know, and that's not your fault. That's just the way it is. It's the process. Now I hear. I understand. You know, I kind of there's been plenty of times where I've been the person in the hole in this fellowship and I've needed other members to jump in with me and show me the way out. Stand there pointing your finger. If you can't help me, get out of the way. You know, that's the way I feel about it. Don't shoot the wounded. I don't care how clean they are. Don't shoot them. You know, So yeah, I kind of stepped into 8 and 9, and in steps 8 and 9, I'm seeking a restitution. I need to recover that which has been lost or stolen. You know, and this disease is the greatest thief I've ever met. It's better than me anyway. And it never seems to go to prison, and I've done 17 years behind the door. You know, and I kind of, you know, without going over all the other step 8s that I clearly didn't do right, you know, I kind of got to this last step 8 and, you know, I'm about to get to another one, and the people that I put on there, I could honestly say that, you know, there was either something there that I owed a direct amends to, or something even there, because there was, you know, I put the person that sexually abused me on my step 8, and in step 9 I went out and executed amends, but not to him, to myself, and I did it by going out and working with young people as a mentor that were or could have been sexually abused. And I did that for 9 months and I found absolute freedom in it. And usually when I talk about that I cry, but for some reason I can't. you know, because it was really beautiful and it brought me freedom. And that's the restitution that I'm talking about, because that was a dark shadow upon my spirit that I could not shift. And if another man looked at me, I wanted to murder you. It's really difficult for me to hug men in this fellowship. Really difficult. And I did it by making my... I didn't do it by making myself unapproachable and seemingly aggressive when really I was scared. That's all it was just fear. So, yeah, kind of quite a long list in step eight. I put this guy on there, I put myself on there. Some people don't agree with that. It's your opinion. I was on my step eight. I needed to be there. I needed to find some forgiveness. I needed to ask God for forgiveness. I'm not a religious person, but I believe in something that's much greater than me. And if I close my eyes and I go to that place, actually what I find is peace and quiet. You know, in this storm. Anyway, I went out and I started to kind of make these amends. You know, and here's another mistake I made. I didn't go out and make amends until I was 7 years clean. I'd sit in meetings, share like Shakespeare, telling people, yeah. And I weren't doing it. And then I'd walk out of, I don't know about anybody else, but I suffer from, you know, denial and delusion. I can convince myself of my own lies. I can convince myself of my own lies. And I kind of got really good practice with that, because out of the 32 Crown Court trials I had, and by the way, I committed every single one of them crimes, I sat in cells for 6 to 9 months practicing the lie of, no, I didn't do it. And I convinced myself I'm really good at it. I need to be able to convince myself of the lie so I can convince Dean. And I got really good at it. So good that I forgot where the truth started and the lie began. And it got really confusing. You know, so I kind of had to go out in step nine, and, you know, like I said, I'm going to go to the core of my shame, the core of my abandonment, the core of my disease, my children. I needed to kind of go out there, and I'm nearly 10 years in. I've got a beautiful daughter. She's beautiful, she's amazing, and she don't talk to me. And you know what? That's how it is. I'm more than confident that if she came into my life, she'd find something that she'd respect and love. But she's too angry right now, and that's okay. God willing, when she's ready, not when I'm ready. You know, I haven't got that right. I abandoned her, and she's got every right to do whatever she needs to do, especially if it works towards me, not away from me. Because I have the ability to push, and I could just push her away more. Step nine is not about harming people. So in step nine, I kind of had to make amends to my son, and, you know, my son wouldn't speak to me for the last 7 years of my using. You know, I also had to make amends to my father, who was extremely violent towards me. He was an alcoholic, he was illiterate, he couldn't read or write. And he was really violent, and where most people got hugged, I got pushed up the wall by my throat. With scratch marks around my neck, and my neck always had scratch marks on it, and I kind of got used to it. It was normal. I thought he was the greatest dad in the world when he'd give me a pound on a Friday, but I actually had massive resentments with him, massive. But my son, you know, and this is really poignant, what happened was my dad acquired prostate cancer, and, you know, he got really ill, and diabetes, and for a number of years he couldn't look after himself. And even though I'd experienced something with my father that didn't make me like the man very much, also I was busy in prison, and like I said, my son had become the political liaison officer for the Houses of Parliament. For the last 5 years of my father's life, my son was his main carer. You know, and I'm really proud of him for that, because I couldn't have done that for that man, but he could. And I suppose what he did was he bonded with my father in the absence of his father, me. Anyway, I kind of remember I was just coming up for 2 years clean, and my dad was kind of, it was, you know, imminent, he was going to die. You know, and I went up to the hospital. I just had one of my first bone grafts, and I walked into the hospital, drove XYZ amount of miles, and on the way my stitches burst, and I was bleeding, and my jeans were all wet, and I was angry, and I was on crutches, and I remember going into this hospital thinking, why am I here? Why am I even here? I don't even want to see this man. But there was something compelling me into that hospital. And I went in there, and he was lying in the bed. He asked me if I had a phone. And I said, yeah. And he gave me a number and told me to dial it. I gave him the phone, and 15 minutes later, my son walked into the room. And I hadn't seen him for 7 years. You know, so, you know, my dad was all right. His heart was in the right place. He just didn't know how to show love. He was unavailable because of this disease and he was untreated. He didn't get what we got. If you're in this meeting and you're not listening, wake up. You know, so from that point, my son said, you know, because I kind of make loads of promises that I constantly break, financial kind of attempts of overcompensation and all that other kind of, you know, that I'm capable of doing. And all he said to me was, "Dad, I just want my dad." And from that point, he's been in my life. It took him 6 years to tell me he was gay. I'm like, "So what?" And, you know, "Where's your boyfriend? Come, let's go and get some food." I've got a persona. You know, I walked into this room and I'm really aware of the diversity of our fellowship. And when I walk in, I don't know about anybody else, but I feel different. You know, and the reason why I feel different is because I'm unique and I'm a fingerprint. And that's okay. Don't want to be a clone. Please don't try to mould me. Allow me the freedom that this fellowship promises us. By whatever means necessary, for whatever God's got intended for me, you know, let it be, innit? Anyway, this man that I resented, that had brought my son back into my life, another act of restitution, I went back to the hospital. And after that, after he'd done that to me, I got into the habit of going down there every 2 weeks. It just sparked something in me. I started seeking that man that had always been unavailable. I was at a point where he was so unavailable that I stopped seeking him. And then when he'd done that for me, I started seeking him again. My mum's exactly the same. I've got a really loving relationship with my mum today as well. And I remember going to the hospital, and he was in a minute. He was going to die, and he was kind of, you know, he was bedridden. The highlight of his day was a spot on the ceiling. He was about, you know, this man used to be about 26 stone. He was a bulky man. He was really intimidating. And I remember walking in, and his eyes focused. He had cataracts and diabetes. His vision wasn't the greatest. And, you know, he couldn't even drink. You'd have to hand him a straw with a cup so that he could sit for me. You know, he's pretty a bag for each. I remember walking up to his bed and I watched the smile touch his lips, the smile spread to his eyes, and I realised he did love me. He did love me. I remember walking up to him, you know, holding his hand, and he was quite weak. I kissed him on his forehead and he died 10 days later. So, you know, even when I didn't know what was going on in this fellowship, what happened for me in the restitution of that relationship with my father was a boulder-like resentment was removed from my heart. And someone said something to me. "Why should your children forgive you if you won't forgive your parents?" Now, I'm not saying that's everybody else's experience. I'm saying that's what was said to me, and it was relevant. Because I'm walking around with this dead weight inside of my spirit, wondering why I can't shift it, and the reason is because I'm being really unforgiving, really intolerant, and a lack of patience, and ironically finding out that they're some of our most valuable spiritual principles. Acknowledged. And I kind of so I had some beautiful experiences in step 9, and I'm yet to experience more. You know, I see a lot of people sitting around on step 8 and it collects dust. You just went from 1 to 8, done all the hard work, and stopped at the joys of this program. That's where the freedom is in step 9. That's why 10, 11 and 12 are called the maintenance steps. You're maintaining what you find in step 9. So now I'm maintaining step 10, 11 and 12. It doesn't make me perfect, but it makes me a lot more bearable to myself and other people. And, you know, I'm involved in a hell of a lot of other people's lives with the minimum of chaos. Still get a bit fruity every now and then. Not perfect. Don't want to be. I wouldn't have a character if I was perfect. Just be something that I don't want to be, really. So I kind of maintain that which has been kind of given to me under the banner of Narcotics Anonymous, because none of this is my gear. I couldn't have done this without this fellowship. I wouldn't have the understanding that I've had without my predecessors, and I definitely wouldn't have learned what I've learned without making any mistakes. Don't care what you're up to. If you need a hug or you need some love, come and see me, I'll give you it. Don't care. So yeah, you know, I kind of maintain the relationships that I've built, hard-won relationships, by taking daily inventory and making sure that I'm keeping up to, you know, up to scratch with my part in it. And if I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. And sometimes when I'm writing inventory and I've had a really good day and a really good a breakthrough in something that I've been struggling around, I make sure it's in my inventory, not just the stuff that I've done wrong. I make sure I put the stuff in there that I've done right or I've had a good experience with. And in step 11, practicing that connection. I don't know what it is. I don't particularly care what people want to label it with names. I don't do all that. I don't go to church. I don't do anything like that. But I believe in God. It's just a name to me. You know, the essence of the spirit that lies behind that name, the stuff that I've been really resistant with, you know, I'm not getting down on my knees. No, I'm not doing that. People might see me. I'm not sitting at a table closing my eyes because everybody's going to see that. I don't really care. What I've discovered is that when I go to that place in step 11 and in prayer and meditation, quiet moments, seeking an energy, a power that's outside of me that will not harm me, and I find it, usually I'm standing on the sea wall, Western Supermare, standing on the sea wall, I can smell the sea, it's really dark, it's really quiet, the cars have stopped moving, the dog, I can hear my dog running around on the beach, and it just comes over me, it's really peaceful and it's really quiet, and it settles me. It doesn't really matter what's going on in the storm of life. And most of the time I find myself standing there, and actually all the problems that I'm kind of digesting ain't even mine. They're other people's. I've got too many sponsees. I love them all, but I've got too many sponsees, man. It can get really overwhelming. Yeah, and in step 12, I just try to carry an honest message with my experience based within the 12-step process of Narcotics Anonymous that set me free. And will continue to do so. If I stop engaging in the process of Narcotics Anonymous, good chance my freedom will stop. I don't ever want to use drugs again. I also never want to experience emotional and spiritual rock bottoms in recovery that are unnecessary. There's lots and lots and lots and lots of stuff that this book, this fellowship, the people in it, and a concept or a connection with a power greater than ourselves can actually protect us from. You know, and I'll end on this. I recently had to go back into the basic text and I read chapter 10, More Will Be Revealed. And that chapter is riddled with warnings about people with longevity of clean time who get cocky and arrogant and we think we know it all. And we get ourselves into a place where actually we're not vulnerable enough to let other people know that we hurt too. And that sometimes, you know what, it'd be nice if we was asked if we was okay. And I say we. I don't care if you're 30, 40, 20, 25 years clean in this room. We're just the same, man. We're just the same and we deserve and, you know, we should be treated equally. You know, of course, if you're my predecessor, you can show me the way out of anything I'm yet to experience. But it don't mean to say that you don't need a hug too. Or some compassion or understanding. You know, so I kind of talk for England, that's what I can do. Talk for England. You know, I love Narcotics Anonymous and the freedom that it's brought into my life. I stand within the fortress of Narcotics Anonymous. I humbly wear a 12-step armour. Sometimes when I take it off, I experience some severe pain and I put it straight back on again. But at least I've got one. You know, and I strongly believe that if I can do this, anyone can. Absolutely anyone. You know, you just got to want it and you've got to do some work for it. You know, lost dreams are woken. I'll leave it there. Thanks.